his autobiography, The Confessions, St. Augustine describes a fascinating moment in the process of his conversion to the Catholic faith. At this point in the story, he's a successful teacher of rhetoric in Milan, looking to prestigious positions in the Roman civil service. He's living with his longtime concubine, his live-in girlfriend, and their son. He has a group of close friends who really care about each other. He has, in other words, everything that he wants. He has success, love, friendship, conversation. He has, at this point in the story, has broken or is about to break with the Manichaeans. This is a Gnostic cult which he spent many years with, teaching and studying. At this point, he's overwhelmed by the limits of human knowledge and skeptical that anyone could come to know the truth about how to live. So he oscillates between this skepticism and his budding interest in the Catholic faith, which he's been receiving through the preaching of Ambrose, later St. Ambrose, who's the Bishop of Milan. So here is how he describes a dialogue that he has with himself at this time, and this is the bottom of the first front page of your handout. Tomorrow I shall find it. It will be perfect. That's the right way to live. It will be perfectly clear, and I shall have no more doubts. Faustus, this is the great Manichaean intellectual, will come and explain everything. What great men the academic philosophers were. Nothing for the conduct of life can be a matter of assured knowledge. Notice he's already oscillated back and forth between thinking he's about to find out everything and he can't know anything. Yet let us seek diligently and not lose heart. The books of the church we know not to contain absurdities. The things which seem absurd can be seen in another way which is edifying. Let me fix my feet on that step where as a boy I was placed by my parents, that's the Catholic Church, and until clear truth may be found. But where can truth be sought? So there, one more oscillation. When can it be sought? Ambrose has no time. There is no time for reading. Where should we look for the books that we need? Where and when can we obtain them? From whom can we borrow them? Fixed times must be kept free, hours appointed for the health of the soul. Great hope has been aroused. Why do we hesitate to knock at the door which opens the way to all the rest? Well, our pupils occupy the mornings. What should we do with the remaining hours? Why not investigate our problem then? But then when should we go to pay respects to our more influential friends, whose patronage we need? When are we to prepare what our students are paying for? When are we to refresh ourselves by allowing the mind to relax from the tension of anxieties? Augustine's language can be lofty and remote, but this is one of his great human moments. He wants to know how to live. He really does. He's not worried about discovering a truth that might scar his career or make it difficult for him to continue living with his live-in girlfriend. He's really not. He's not worried about any of that. He just doesn't have time. He's too busy between his students and his patrons, and Ambrose is busy too. He doesn't have time to read. He doesn't have time to get the books. Too bad for Augustine. He can't figure out the best way to live. He's just too busy. Earlier in the same section of the Confessions, Augustine describes how busy Ambrose is. Now, Ambrose is busy. Bishops at that time were expected to adjudicate disputes between members of their flock, which was an endless and endlessly demanding task. This is a little side note, but I can't resist it. The life of a bishop is so hectic, in fact, that later in life, after he's become Catholic, Augustine will do almost anything to avoid being appointed a bishop. The historian Peter Brown describes him going from town to town in Africa, avoiding carefully any occasion when he might be appointed bishop by acclamation, which is the way that it was done in those times. Alas, he's tricked. In Hippo, which is, of course, where he was bishop, he finds himself at a liturgy, ostensibly for another purpose, that becomes his own election as a bishop. Tears pour down his face in the scene that Peter Brown describes, because his life of philosophical leisure is over. So anyway, Ambrose is very busy because he is a bishop at this time in this style. Yet Augustine describes with reverence what Ambrose does in the short moments in which he does not have an appointment. He reads silently. He does not restrict. This is at the first text on your handout. He reads silently. He doesn't restrict access to visitors. He sits and reads, passing his eyes over the page. Augustine and his friends come in and watch him, but he shows no sign of disturbance. They clearly find this scene a matter of awe. He is chosen, Ambrose has, to return within himself, to become a sort of island of stillness. His reading, it seems, is a kind of prayer, and it's certainly an example of leisure of the kind that we're interested in. So what is leisure, and why is it necessary for human beings? So the leisure I'm interested in is not the first thing you may imagine, which is lounging at the beach, or a festive party with friends, or launching yourself into the largest human catapult in the world for the thrill of it. The leisure that's necessary for human beings is none of these things. It's not the beach, it's not pleasure, it's not just a break from real life, or a place where we rest and restore ourselves in order to go back to work. What we're after when we're looking for what leisure is something that looks like the culmination of a life. So I could ask you as the audience, each of you, to think for a minute about what parts of your life seem to be the culminating parts, the days or hours or minutes where it seems to you that you are living life to the fullest. What sorts of things might you be doing? In what ways are you active at those moments? So let's just think a little bit about the kinds of things that we do, we human beings. We do many things instrumentally for the sake of something else. You know, we eat breakfast to calm hunger pains. We put gas in the car for the sake of getting somewhere. We exercise to stay healthy. We work for money. We have children, sometimes to placate a spouse or to fit in. Other things we do for their own sake, play cards, go for hikes, read, build model airplanes. Some things are evidently both instrumental and for their own sake. We also have children for their own sake, of course. We work for money, but sometimes also for the love of our work activities. We fish to eat, but also for the sport of it. We play cards for fun, but also to unwind. We have many goals, often at the same time, but certain goals have a structuring or ordering effect over others. We choose our career to permit some extra time with our families. We choose a less demanding family to allow free upward movement in our careers. Our ultimate end, family in the first case, or success in the second, frames and structures our other pursuits. We trade a freer schedule for more money or sacrifice a higher salary for more time to pursue our heart's desire. The structuring effect of some goals over others suggests we have a basic orientation that's determined by our ultimate end, the goal, assuming that there is one, which structures all of our other choices. Such a goal is our highest good, whether we've chosen it as such, or whether it's grown inadvertently or haphazardly out of internal pressures or social pressures. That highest good or ultimate end might be wealth or social status or family life, serving our community, enjoying the natural world, knowledge of God, writing novels, the pursuit of mathematical truth. We may not know, we probably don't, in fact, what in the soup of our desires matters most to us. We discover it in times of trial or crisis, when the chips are down, a difficult choice at work, a family member in the hospital bed. These are the moments when you understand what matters most to you and why. What would happen if we tried to organize our lives around merely instrumental pursuits? We're not likely to do so for grocery shopping, laundry, taxes. But we might, for instance, for making money, or even for making the world a better place, as Ambrose does. That too is an instrumental good. It's something we do for the sake of something else. The philosopher Aristotle argued that our ultimate end had to be sought for its own sake, or our actions would turn out to be empty and vain. Now, what does he mean by this? It's clear enough my actions are vain when I don't achieve my small-scale goal. So I want to go swimming, I pack my swim bag, I put on my shoes, I get my keys, I drive to the pool, and I find it closed. Okay, my end goal of swimming has been frustrated, and my string of actions was in vain. But it's also true that if my ultimate goal, the thing around which my life is organized, is not sought for its own sake, many or most of my actions will also be in vain. Here's another example. Suppose the pool is open and I get to swim. Why do I do it? I swim for the sake of health. I want to be healthy so I can work. I work for the sake of money, and the money is for the sake of food, drink, housing, recreation, and exercise, all of which make it possible for me to work. Let me do that one more time. Okay, I swim for the sake of health. I want to be healthy so I can work. I work for the sake of money, and the money is for the sake of all the things that make it possible for me to work. The reason why that's so hard to understand is because it doesn't make any sense. I've described a life of utter futility. If I work for the sake of money, spend money on the basic necessities for life, and my life is organized around working, my life is a pointless spiral of work for the sake of work. It's like buying ice cream, immediately selling it for cash, spending the proceeds on ice cream, which one once again sells, and so on and so forth. You never get to actually eat the ice cream. It's just as tragic or more as working for money and getting crushed by a falling anvil on the way to cash your paycheck. Activities are not worthwhile unless they're satisfying in themselves or unless they culminate in something satisfying. For this reason, Aristotle argued that there must be some activity or activities beyond work, leisure for the sake of which we work, and without which our work is in vain. Leisure is not merely recreation, which we might undertake for the sake of work, to relax or rest before beginning to labor anew the weekend at the beach so you're refreshed to go back to work. Rather, leisure, as I've said, is an activity or set of activities that could count as the culmination of all our endeavors. For Aristotle, only contemplation could be ultimately satisfying in this way, the activity of seeing and understanding and savoring the world as it is. So that's the philosophical account of leisure, and for those of you who didn't come for the philosophy, there won't be much more of it. What does this contemplative leisure look like in real life? And here we go to the next slide. I've collected a few examples. This is Renée, heroine of the French art house film a few years ago called The Hedgehog. She's the concierge of a wealthy apartment building in Paris. Next one. Her work is humble. She cleans, takes mail, organizes workmen. But her real life is elsewhere. In a hidden room behind her kitchen, she reads philosophy, literature, and classics. This is her secret life, and the drama of the movie is built around those in the building who discover it and form a friendship with her accordingly. The middle-aged heroine of The Hedgehog echoes a similar figure in an earlier film. This is the German filmmaker's, Fassbinder's classic, Ali Fear Eats Soul, very German sounding name. Emmy is a cleaning lady. She's the bottom of the social barrel. She falls in love with a younger Moroccan guest worker to the horror of her xenophobic children and neighbors. Yeah. Here's an image of the refuge these two people find with one another. A space away from demeaning judgments, where they contemplate one another in their simple, vulnerable humanity. These two people, this elderly, middle-aged woman, past her childbearing years, and this alien refugee worker. This film is more tragic than The Hedgehog, since they rely on one another for their refuge, since they have within themselves the expectations of their social world, the refuge doesn't last. The leisured contemplation in loving relationships is worth mentioning, since I think it is the type of leisure most commonly recognized and valued and sought after. But I want to return to the less recognized but more traditional intellectual form of leisure. Renee sequestered in her room reading may seem like a quirky, unusual image, the sort of thing you might expect in a French art house film. But it's in fact very traditional. Consider the medieval and Renaissance paintings of the Virgin Mary at the Annunciation, when the angel arrives with his invitation to her to bear Christ. In these images, she's often reading, sometimes a prayer book or a psalter, but sometimes she's clearly, as in this one, engaged in very serious study. She's got a lot of books. Sometimes she's reading the passage of Isaiah where it's prophesied that a virgin will give birth to the Messiah. She's always sheltered, as you can see in these images. I think there's one more. She's always alone and separated from the outside world. I think keep it there for a little bit. So these images of Our Lady have their origins in the fathers of the church, who in their commentaries on Luke sought to explain the difference between Mary's confident, faithful questioning of the angel, asking how can this be, and Zechariah's earlier mocking disbelief. The fathers insisted that she would have known the prophecies of the Messiah through her reading and studying. Furthermore, it was evident to them that she would have had all the virtues and that the virtue of wisdom would have required study. So here is, I'm just going to read this out, you don't have it. St. Ambrose, again, in perhaps the earliest suggestion that Mary was reading at the Annunciation. She, Mary, when the angel entered, was found at home in privacy, without a companion, that no one might interrupt her attention or disturb her. And she did not desire any women as companions who had the companionship of good thoughts. Moreover, she seemed to herself to be less alone when she was alone. For how should she be alone, who had with her so many books, so many archangels, so many prophets? The images of study and intellectual life as a leisured refuge are older than Christianity. They have their origins in ancient Greek philosophy. So Plato describes his, his teacher Socrates, all dressed up for a dinner party, standing at the threshold and suddenly losing himself in thought, losing track of where he is and thinking about something for an extended period of time. He also describes him as able to find this kind of space to think even when he's away at war at the Battle of Potidaea. The great mathematician Archimedes, who engineers note is probably the founder of engineering in the West, learn about him, he's wonderful. And he's partly wonderful for this famous story, which this is depicted here. By legend, he was so lost in his theorems that he did not notice the Romans invading his native city of Syracuse. And he was killed by a Roman soldier when he insisted on finishing his proof before being taken to the Roman officials. And later writers gave him last words, "Don't disturb my circles." Okay. So anyway, it's the beautiful story of Archimedes. Now, so far I've given you images of from fiction, film, legend, ancient tradition. The Russian dissident Irina Rutushinskaya, so the rest of the examples I have are from, I found a lot of examples in stories from Eastern Europe in early in the 20th century of dissidents in prison. So this woman, Rutushinskaya, describes in her autobiography prisoners in transport passing poetry to one another written out on little scraps of paper. She herself, during her imprisonment in Siberia, scratched poems onto soap bars with matchsticks and until she could memorize them. Then she'd wash them away and write them on cigarette paper so that they could be smuggled to the West. A Romanian officer imprisoned in Siberia wrote out poems he had memorized in school with ink that he made out of blackberries. Or other Romanian prisoners tapped poetry in Morse codes, Morse code, singular, through the walls of the prison, or taught each other languages on pieces of string coated by knots. So I hope you find these examples as moving as I do. I think I want to say something now about what explains, I think, their power. I think they show the dignity of human beings, these tales of leisure in adverse circumstances. They indicate that a human being is not reducible to his or her social uses. So the forcible diminishment of, for instance, the prisoners in Siberia is an attempt at thought control to make them think or speak as authorities would like them to be, an attempt to make them into purely social or political beings. Likewise, the more commonplace diminishment of working people, such as building supervisors or cleaning ladies, does not suppress the splendor of a human being, or it does so only superficially. Lastly, in the example of Our Lady, her solitude in these images shows her independence from the social world, her having a value that's beyond what's given to her by those circumstances. And in that way, it's an image of her virginity, which is a sign that, to me, that she's valued for her own sake. That is, if you think about her culture, a woman is valued for sexual pleasure or the continuing of bloodlines through families, and Our Lady is more than that. She has a dignity that's beyond price. She belongs to God and to God alone. And that's, I think, part of the power of these images. So we see all of these characters, whether they're fictional or not, choosing forms of leisure, thinking, study, prayer, love, in the face of opposition, resistance, or outright hostility. Now, these are exceptional human beings, people with great virtues or extraordinary graces. Sometimes hostile circumstances can make leisure virtually impossible. So the clearest example I can think of is from a book that's not commonly read anymore, Jack London's semi-autobiographical novel, Martin Eden. So Eden is a working person. He's taken up a habit of self-improvement, of extended study and thinking and reading. But he has to live. So he takes up a job at a laundry where he works 14-hour days, 6 days a week. At the end of 1 week of this type of work, he's unable to think or focus or read. He's totally lost touch with the inner life that he was cultivating so carefully. And he instead is drawn towards simple forms of release, which are not admirable. Drinking, prostitutes, you name it. Consider in a more contemporary or real-world context the situation of the Amazon warehouse worker as described in the account given by James Bloodworth, who's a journalist who just wrote about it. Such a person also works, like Martin Eden, long, strenuous shifts. Their company executives have chosen to hire out many of their workers through temp companies. Every move is monitored with surveillance bracelets. They're penalized for bathroom breaks or for illness. The company holds out the promise of rewards that never materialize, changes schedules capriciously, docks their pay, sometimes by mistake, and in general makes life so riven with anxiety that cheap pleasures become enormously attractive, even to those who they had not been previously. So now I'd like us, the last part of this talk, to face a puzzle. So here is the puzzle. I've talked about a little bit about what leisure is philosophically. I've given some real life examples. I've suggested some ways when it might be found in difficult circumstances, why it might really matter, and also some cases where it might be very difficult or impossible to find. But remember, we began with Augustine, who couldn't find the time to do what mattered most. He was too busy. If leisure, and he I think presents the puzzle, if leisure is what our lives culminate in, if it's the thing at which our desires aim at, how could we fail to achieve it, especially we, those of us who are not in terrible circumstances, that is, not imprisoned in Siberia or working at extremely difficult jobs. What is the obstacle for us, or what are the obstacles, plural, to our attaining this kind of good? So if we turn back to the restless workaholic Augustine, we notice what should have been obvious. It's not true that he doesn't have time. The fact is that he, like us, has two minds about leisure. He wants it and he doesn't want it. He, on the one hand, is committed to other things, you know, his career, his girlfriend, but he's also, I think, like us, afraid of what might happen in spaces of leisure. So work itself is, of course, a good thing. It's the way we serve our communities. And that's true if we work at a business that supplies something that people need to live, if we work to raise our children, if we work as teachers, electricians, garbage collectors, healthcare aides, what have you. But good things, as we know, are not always good. So food is a good thing, but we still overeat. Sex is a good thing. How would we have come into existence without it? But we could use it in demeaning or dehumanizing or otherwise harmful ways. So how do we misuse work? How can it become something that isn't good? Well, I'm not sure how often all of us think of it as truly being a service, as a way of serving our community, rather than, say, a vehicle for money or for status. I think it's difficult to be genuinely open to serving our communities however we're most needed, even if that serving that need doesn't pay much or has a low social status. We think of our American culture, the culture that we share with much of Western Europe, as a culture that values work. But I fear that it's not really work that we value. What we value often is money and status. And we can value those things to the point where we don't care what the cost is, or we don't notice the cost in other human goods. And I think it's connection of work with money and with status that allows work to become a sort of addiction, compulsion. It's at least part of it. After all, remember Augustine, he works a lot, but his main focus, by his own admission, is on his social advancement. So too, remember Ambrose. He has more work than anybody, but he knows how to use his breaks, his pieces of free time. His leisure shows us what he cares about most. It shows both why his work matters and why it doesn't matter what he has in his life that's more than his work. That's to say, on the one hand, we are attracted to other things than leisure. That's one part of the picture of why we don't have it. But the other thing about it is, as I say, we fear it, as I think Augustine expresses in the passage that I started with. Now, what is it in us that flees from leisure? What is Augustine afraid of? Let me just speculate that in some way it's our own emptiness. St. John of the Cross, the great medieval mystic, compares the soul of human beings to enormous caverns, huge empty caves, empty, and when they're recognized as empty, are recognized as waiting to be filled with God. This is on the one hand a beautiful image. On the other hand, I think it's meant to be fairly terrifying. That is, we don't want to think of ourselves as being enormous, hollow, empty caverns. We don't like to think of ourselves as being basically receptive, open, waiting. We want to fill the emptiness with anything we can find in order to not face that. So what keeps us, I think, from cultivating leisure is our unwillingness to face our dependence on what comes from the outside, our need to wait for God to act. This dependence and its need are, I think, in real life, objectively terrifying. Okay, what's going to come when you sit and wait? What will you find in yourself when you sit in silence and look at yourself? It might be something that you don't like about yourself or that makes you uncomfortable or ashamed or a certain sort of weakness. Or we might find that we're not quite the people that we think we are in some other way. So leisure, everything good in life, I suppose, turns out to be a sort of discipline. It's not enough just to choose a type of activity of the form that's classically considered leisurely, study, appreciating nature. Even things like prayer can become, because of the forces within a human being, used for ends that are not leisurely. So you may all know, if you know people in religious life, it's, you can dedicate your life. What could be more leisurely than a life devoted to God in a monastery, a life devoted to prayer? But of course, you can get there, and out of fear of what you find in that leisure, you can treat the monastery like you would anywhere else, right? You could want to just achieve the best possible liturgies, you know, just produce the best, most beautiful music in the world, or to treat the monastery as you would any social unit and try to make your way through whatever the social ranks are that exist. The capacity of human beings to turn into distractions, things which are intrinsically good, is more or less boundless. So it requires discipline and care, virtues of courage, and of course, the grace of God. So I hope that the examples I've presented have shown you not only that leisure might be something worth finding or noticing in your own life, but also something which is possible to achieve, that is, with careful cultivation and with God's grace. So thank you all. So I think something like that must be right. So you could, but there are limits. So I think, for instance, even though it's not part of the tradition, either in ancient philosophy or in its use by someone like Aquinas, it's traditional to think that manual labor is not leisurely. I think that's not true. So you can work with your hands and find leisure in it, find space to reflect and think and find peace in it. And it can feel like the culmination of who you are. But on the other hand, there are activities that are more or less natural to it. So it's hard to attain leisure in like a long car commute or in one of the kinds of jobs I'm talking about where you're working like 14-hour days and no breaks and it's hard work and you're not being treated well by your employers. So there's a, whereas prayer, the traditions of the church, liturgies, study, appreciating nature, leisure time with people that you love, those are kind of the natural places where leisure happens. And so it's not just a matter of your intention, it's also a matter of seeking out the kinds of activities that are going to be natural to it.
Yeah. Are certain people called to more or less leisure?
That's a really interesting question. I'd be inclined to say yes. But I hadn't really thought about a life of more or less leisure. Partly because I think each person, no matter what their call is, has to find it, and it's always a struggle, no matter what the vocation is. So that said, I think that one of the reasons why people like me who work too much—it's very ironic that I teach about leisure because I work all the time. If I go to a monastery, I just feel instantly this intense sense of peace, right? Now, that kind of life is more leisurely, even though it's susceptible to the kinds of problems I'm talking about. So someone like that might be called the moral leisure, and there might be people who, due to circumstances, just can't, you know, it's extremely difficult for them to find it, and the kind of leisure that they get is something that's fleeting. But I would like to think that in most lives, at some point, there's time to cultivate it. So, you know, maybe not when, you know, you've got 5 kids under 7. You know, that might not be the time when leisure becomes most obvious. You may have find time later in your life for that to be possible.
Sometimes I hear things and I'm wrong about what I heard. So let's just start there. Okay.
That never happens to me, but okay.
Yeah. And then I have a follow-up question based on how this question
okay.
is. Cool. So were you saying that, like, earnest contemplation, you were, like, saying that's what leisure is, or that's what that's what leisure is?
I did say that, and I do believe that. There was a earlier version of the talk, which I probably shouldn't have left out, which is there's a variety of types of contemplation, as I understand it. So, you know, that scene of the couple, you know, who are finding this refuge in each other, they're contemplating one another, mm-hmm. okay? So that's a kind of loving contemplation that you have in relationships. Or you could contemplate, you know, the way the sky looks, you know, when you're driving to work. It doesn't have to be intellectual study. That's where the tradition is. So that's where the idea of leisure originated. And I think you can learn a lot from that. And of course, it's dear to my heart because I'm a professional intellectual. Yeah. But it's not the only form of contemplation.
Yeah. And so then my second one, and I think you started to answer it, you were talking about how, you know, we need to seek it, but also that two-mindedness, double-mindedness, we also avoid it because of what we might find during contemplation.
Right.
So, and we're talking about leisure and contemplation as a thing that's worthy in of itself to do.
Right.
So it's like, okay, so we should contemplate because contemplation is good. But it seems like there has to be some object of our contemplation, something that we are considering. Are there things that we ought to contemplate and things we ought to avoid contemplating?
Oh, no, that's a great question. Yes, so, wow, that's a hard question in a lot of ways. You can look at things without contemplating them. So a lot of the things that I would say would not be good to look at would actually be difficult to contemplate. Our attraction to them is not to contemplate them, it's to, some kind of thrill seeking. So the example I'm thinking of is actually in the Confessions. Have people read Augustine's Confessions? You all should, it's the best. It's so good. There's this one scene where he has a friend named Alypius who is very upright. This is before he too becomes Catholic. He converts at the same time. But before he becomes Catholic, he's very upright, very principled sort of person. And he doesn't want to go see the gladiator games, which take place where they're living. And his friends drag him. You know, he's like, you can drag me if you want, but I'm going to cover my eyes and I'm not going to look. So he's sitting there with his eyes covered. He's like, I'm not watching. But he hears the roar of the crowd, and then he just can't help but just... And then he's instantly just hooked on gladiator games, and he can't do anything else but watch them. So that's an example of something where there's a kind of desire to look at something that seems a little bit like contemplation, because why do you want to see it? Well, there's something, you know, you're like, oh, I didn't know a body could do that. You know, oh, I didn't... But so there's a difference between contemplation and thrill seeking. If you're contemplating, and if your purpose is really to understand and to learn and to be wise and to seek out the highest things, then I actually think that there isn't anything that you shouldn't be able to contemplate, at least from a certain kind of distance, so long as you don't get hooked into thrill-seeking types of looking. So you can learn a ton from anything. I mean, you know, if you think about the world God has created, You know, everything that is, this is also Augustine, has some aspect of God in it, right? So you can learn a ton from it, but I think the danger is that pull towards thrill-seeking that affects a lot of people like me and people who are academic or intellectual. A lot of us are very susceptible to this kind of thing. You know, there's this kind of thrill of knowing for the sake of knowing or seeing for the sake of seeing. That's off. So it's more the inner character of the activity than it is the object. Okay. Does that help?
Yeah, thank you.
Sure. Yeah.
What would you say the effect of leisure is? Is that, you said what you were talking about is the realizing the emptiness and
right.
How much
I think I don't talk about the effect of leisure because it could have any number of kinds of effects. It could have the effect of despair at one's own emptiness or painful recognition of something in yourself that you didn't want to recognize. But it could also be joyful, peaceful, it can have all kinds of effects. One of the reasons why I think it's important to think of it as being something that's sought for its own sake is that you're seeking it not for the effects, but for something that's in it. So it has a certain character, this gets back to the previous question, has a certain inner character that you learn to know when you see it or when you experience it, which again can be a mixture of, it can one time be something peaceful and another time something very difficult. And it's just not obvious what you're gonna get. I mean, I don't know, I've spent a lot of time in monasteries, as you might be able to tell. I sometimes go and have this blissful, peaceful feeling of being with God. Other times I go and I suddenly see something in my life that I really did not wanna see. And it can be extremely painful and difficult. Now, the first silent retreat I ever went on, I was like, oh my gosh, all this stuff was in my own mind. You know, I thought it was in my life, but in fact, it was me. Now, that's not a pleasant feeling. So I think it's, you have to approach it from different directions rather than trying to think about what the effect is. Excuse me.
Also, just quick, would you say that some recreation could be leisure? Obviously, not all leisure is recreation.
Yeah, you know, I've struggled with that because I think sometimes it's really hard to tell the difference, truthfully. I mean, I think about, like, camping, you know, which is something I really like. And, you know, you're out in nature and you just are enjoying what you're doing for its own sake. And I think, strictly speaking, that's recreation. But there's leisure that got mixed into it, probably because it has to do with the natural world and creation and points beyond itself or something like that.
What would you define recreation?
Well, so the recreation is what you would do for the sake of resting in order to go back to work.
Okay.
So it's like your coffee break, your weekend at the beach in order to be restored for work. So that's the technical difference, is recreation is for the sake of work, whereas leisure is what work is for. But I think in the detailed activities, it can be hard to tell the difference.
So leisure and rest are not the same thing to you?
See, I haven't used the word rest. See, I'm trained in philosophy, so you have to get used to, like, word splitting, you know. So I haven't used the word rest because rest can be both used for recreation, right? I gotta get some rest so I can do some work. Or there's also, you know, come to me, all the you who labor, I shall be your rest. That's a different kind of rest, right? That's not taking a nap on a sunny afternoon. Yes. I definitely think that working too much does not facilitate access to leisure. So I think many people I know work too much, and that's including myself. So that suggests to me that yes, recreation can. But yeah, so I think it becomes difficult to say what's going on at a certain point. So I have a good friend who I think of as being the person who, I mean, he's actually the non-religious person who I know who most embodies leisure, you know, and doesn't much like his job, looks after his houseplants, and likes to be outdoors and sort of just plugged into the world around him and is really intensely involved in various activities. Do I want to say that those are recreational? They're not directed at his work. They're space that, like, a lot of people have their lives outside of work, which is, I think, healthy. So at that point, it's not recreation anymore. It's the point of your life. Yes?
Okay, so you brought up Matthew 28, talking about, like, come to me, all those who are weary and I will give you rest.
Right.
Do you believe that Jesus is, like, the path, kind of, like, facilitates the path to rest, considering in the Old Testament, God's people had to sacrifice things and basically kind of had to work for their salvation, whereas Jesus came and died on the cross for us, and we don't have to work for that anymore because he has already taken that up and taken our salvation. Do you think that, like, now, like, in present day, Jesus was the way for us to kind of attain that leisure easier?
That's a tough question for me. You know, I'm actually a convert myself, and I converted pretty late in life. And I learned a lot from my non-religious family and from the sort of ancient philosophy that I studied when I was in graduate school, which, you know, got taken up into the Christian tradition through people like Augustine and the church fathers. So what I think is something like this. It's going to sound different from what you said. I don't know whether it will fit it exactly. Leisure is a human good. It's natural to human beings. It's not exclusive to Christians. But I think Christianity offers, on the one hand, a more profound, full, incredible notion of rest, right? There's a whole eschatological view of the world where there's union with God waiting at the end of it. That's extremely profound. That's not something you find in other, in the pagan traditions. So on the one hand, there's a difference in what leisure ultimately means, which for Christians is ultimately the beatific vision in heaven. On the other hand, I also think, of course, the grace of Christ helps us in all of our difficulties, right? So any difficulty, including the difficulty of how am I going to find time to the difficulty that Augustine describes, right? Like, oh, I just don't have time to figure this out. You know, I've got too much to do. That kind of difficulty, grace helps us through those things. But it is, I do think it's important to think about the connections between Christianity and the human goods, the natural goods. That's, I think, important to me, and I think it's also important to the Dominicans who run the Thomistic Institute, so I feel I should, apart from believing in it, I feel like I have special license to emphasize it. Yes?
So I read an article a few years ago that sort of lamented, and it was a little bit nostalgic, but lamented the way Western culture has kind of transformed leisurely activities into work. So, you know, you used to just play tennis, so you just kind of hack around with your friends, and that was fine. And now you're, like, wearing the gear, and you're buying the professional racket, and going and taking lessons.
Right.
You know, even like going to the gym and just, you know, running and lifting some weights, we call it working out.
Right.
It's work now. It's
right.
Like,
right. Right.
So, do you think that those that transforms those activities and things that are not leisurely, and do you think that may be a way to identify leisure is that absence of use or utility or some end other than just enjoying this thing?
So I think that's definitely true. So I haven't read this article, but I agree with it 100%. Because I think that a lot of what is happening is, our leisure activities are becoming less leisurely. So I was reading an article more recently about children's sports how they become incredibly competitive. You know. And what's the point of sports for children? Well, it's so you have a good time. You know, you learn a few things about, you know, how to play with teams, and but it's part of why I think leisure is endangered is there's so much emphasis on achievement, you know, and you know you can't just do something, you know, you can't just play piano for the fun of it. You know, you've got to be really good at it. You know, you've got to be really good at working out. You've got to have metrics that measure how good you are, you know, your personal best, you know. So I take kind of pleasure in not paying attention to my personal best. Say swimming, which is what I do for exercising. You know, I just enjoy it. Do it for a while, you know, fixed amount of time. Don't think about achieving. So it's... That said, it can be tricky because, of course, we also want to become excellent in certain ways. But I think it's invaded into areas of life where it's not appropriate. So, yeah, that seems right to me.
You know, you have a portion in your presentation because now you said it has invaded into.
Yeah.
But at some point in your presentation, you made it look like it was innate in us to do that.
Yes.
It's not Western civilization
that's right.
That's doing this to us. It's
that's
us
right.
Doing this to ourselves.
No, I know you're absolutely right. Yes, thank you for that correction. You're right. I mean, it can feel that way, though. Partly because...
We're saying that somebody else is imposing these things.
No, you're right. You're right. So it comes from us. But I also believe there's such a thing as a culture, right? There's social habits which influence the way we do things. So when I say it is happening, I think I meant something like that. But you're right, that we are the source and we are also the solution, right? With God's help, right? That we can choose to set up a sporting league for kids that is for the sake of fun rather than, you know, excellence in sports for everybody, you know, and the losers have to leave. So, anyway, but thank you for the correction.
There is a program that Bishop Barron just put out, it's called The Mass, and one of the sentences that he mentions there that stuck with me and it kind of resonates with your talking today. He says, the Mass is the ultimate form of play. And
yeah.
The way he explains that.
That beautiful.
Is he says, the difference between work and play, work is what we do in order to achieve something else. So I have to go to work in order to get money so I can buy a better tennis racket,
right.
So I can play tennis.
Right.
he says, play is what you do for the joy of it itself.
That's right.
And then he says, of all the things that we do for play, the Mass should be the ultimate form of play because there is no purpose for it other than the joy of being in the presence of God, which is the actual act in which we should take, the context in which we should place the Mass. So I thought that was interesting because from that perspective, that would be the ultimate form of leisure, which would relate to something that you guys were asking before. So I feel very, personally, I feel very inclined to seek leisure that way.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that? Or?
Oh, sure. No, I agree with that. It is the ultimate form of leisure. This is kind of the way I am. I reinvent the wheel for myself. You know, things that are obvious to other people aren't to me. So it took me a while of being Catholic when I realized that all the other sacraments have some purpose, right? So, you know, they've got the sacraments of initiation, baptism, confirmation. They bring you in, okay? Or marriage, you know, it's a blessing of this particular relationship. Or healing, okay, you're sick, you've got to get better. Ordination, you've got to be better. So the Eucharist, confession, you know, it's like being sick, right? You've got to get, so the Eucharist is the one sacrament that's really for its own sake, just as you were saying.
Yeah.
It's, we would do that if everything was, this is what we do in heaven, this is what we do here. We do it whether we're in good shape, bad shape. We do it. We don't do it for the sake of some effect or something that we get from it. It's so. I agree with that. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
Okay. So one recognizes that they should do leisure.
Mm-hmm.
they take the time and they do a true leisure as you described.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the end?
Can you say a little more about where the question's coming from?
Or should there be some, at least not all the time maybe, but is there times when there should be an effect on your life, a change in your life from the leisure?
I think it does affect your life. This goes back to the earlier question. I think it does affect your life, but I don't think that's why you do it.
I understand.
Yeah, so it's a bit like going to mass, right? I mean, it does affect your life, but you don't say like, you know, okay, 20 more masses and I'm going to be in good shape. Or you don't say, wow, that was a really lousy mass. You know, I was sad the whole time. You know, gotta try again next time. Or you're not making an effort like, am I going to receive communion right this time? You know, you just let yourself go in it. So, but I feel like there's more behind your question that you're not.
No, there isn't.
That's
it. But I'm saying well, you're talking about the mass.
Yeah.
Well, the word mass itself comes from the word from dismissal to go out and become disciples.
See.
So on the mass, it should be a change in you.
Yeah.
To go out and take what you've gained from the mass to go out and become a better disciple of Christ.
So
there is something that should affect your life.
I think I understand. So that's all true. And of course, it's also true that work is more important than I was suggesting in my talk, right? So work is really important. Yeah. Taking care of the community is, you've got to do it. It's essential, it's important, it's beautiful, it's profound, it's a place where you can exercise the virtues. So all of that's very important, but there is a tendency in us and in our culture to think that if we're not getting results from something, it's worthless. So in these talks and in my writing on these things, I'm trying very hard to push as hard as I can in the other direction. Not because I think that's the whole truth about the life. There's all kinds of important things that need to be done. There's all kinds of important effects that are worth promoting. But I just don't want this thing to be lost, this other thing, which is that there are certain things which matter for their own sake, and you seek them out for that reason and for no other reason. It also happens that they make your life better, and they make the community better, and so on. I think it's essential to think of them as not in terms of those effects, but in terms of what they are in themselves. Does that make sense?
No, and that's what I sort of was getting at, because I understand that the leisure, but I can't see it as always being an end in itself, especially like what you said, if you take leisure time and you contemplate, and you find that there is something in your life that maybe needs to change because you don't like it.
Right.
So should that be the end? And you say, well, I know there's something in my life I should change. I don't like it. Then okay.
Well, but think about what, for instance, we would be doing in heaven, right? What are we going to be doing? Fixing ourselves? No.
No.
So part of our faith involves believing that there's at least some point, and not just then, but also here on earth, where we are living fully in that moment. And so I'm thinking about the ways, what that means, where it comes from, and all the forms that it takes. I would never want to say it was bad for you. Of course it is. It's good for you. I'm just trying to push against the making everything an achievement. That's all.
I sort of gathered that.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So I have another question. I have a follow up question after this one. But do you think it's important to be out in the nature, or do you think that has a pretty big impact on attaining leisure? Like doing things in discipline, like being out in nature, like you said, prayer and studying. Do you think that one would be a big part of that?
I think nature. This is at least where I'm thinking. a lot of this stuff I'm still figuring out. I mean, for me, I think about things for a long, long time. but my thought at this point is that being out in nature is probably the most, like, that almost, that works for more or less everyone. So some people just don't take to studying. They just, it's not for them. Prayer also for everyone, right? So even people who don't believe, right, they, in their moment of crisis, they'll call on God. So prayer and being outdoors, it just does, you know, it just does something. Something in you relaxes. And it's true, I think, more or less universally. Something about the beauty of nature, something about being outside, something about being away from the social parts of life. Anyway, I think that's true. I think nature is crucial.
Okay, and we're gonna follow up of that.
Sure.
Since like nature is important and everything, do you think it's detrimental to attaining leisure that forest, like to live in this developed country where we're cutting down forests and where we're trying to improve technology and improve things and like basically work for the better good, but in it, like, and a side effect of doing that, we're cutting down trees and we're like, you know, we're kind of destroying the planet. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that is detrimental to our leisure since we value being in nature?
Well, I think that that's getting a little bit out of my sphere of knowledge because I mean, in some way, yes, obviously, you know, I know that there are things people do that are destructive and that don't need to be done. But from what I understand these situations, there's often, you know, competing goods and how you balance the one against the other. You know, I try to read about it and then I get puzzled and I just think, you know, there's only so much you can do in your life. I'm never going to come to clarity about this. I don't know enough about materials and land and, for that matter, the preservation of nature. I do think the preservation of nature is very important, and especially the preservation of nature that's accessible for people to go and recover this part of themselves. But beyond that, I couldn't say. Yes.
Go ahead. Would you say, I mean, if I understand you correctly, you keep insisting that leisure is something we do for the pleasure of doing it itself.
That's right.
Itself, not for any other benefit.
That's right.
I also heard you push back hard when,
yeah,
even if a long-term benefit is going to be experienced,
yeah,
it wouldn't be leisure if you're doing it in
right.
the quest of a benefit.
That's right.
Would you say, I mean, it occurred to me that a perfect example would be somebody paints. I have a friend
yeah.
who paints, and she paints, and
yeah.
for the sake of painting.
Right.
No other sake. Until somebody went to her home and said, I love that one. Can I buy it?
Right.
So she sold it.
Right.
And then she painted another one pretty much like that one. She sold it again, and now she's ruining it. Now she's just, she can't paint anymore. She has to do that specific So she has to find something else to do for leisure that is not painting.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The moment that it gets objective value,
yeah,
it looks like we just ruin the leisure in and of itself. So instead of going into a creative venue,
yeah,
becoming something that in the long term might enrich your life becomes work.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would go quite that far. I think that does happen, what you're describing, where it becomes useful and then it loses its flavor. You know, maybe you don't enjoy the wilderness as much when you're a paid park
tour
ranger,
guide, yeah.
yeah, or tour guide as you are when you can just go for fun of it. But I also think that there can be ways of carving out ways of experiencing the leisure in something, even when it's useful. Think again about a priest at mass, right? Okay, they're doing their job, right? That's their job. But if they don't find leisure in it, then something's
so
gone off.
So it's impossible to find leisure at work. It's a rarity, but it could be.
It's not. It is possible. Yes, it's difficult, but it's possible. I think what's close to impossible in this life is having your whole life be leisure. I don't think that is possible. I think you can find it at work, at least in moments. I mean, the same way that if you have, you know, if you have this five kids under seven, right, you're crazy busy and your mind is half rutted, but you have moments where you see what you're doing, and it's very profound, and you can find the leisure in it, not for long, but for a certain period of time. So I, you know, I don't want to go too far in thinking that use ruins things completely. It just makes it more difficult. Go ahead.
On the back point, are you describing a moment of clarity as being a moment of leisure?
I think sometimes, maybe that's right.
But that's not my question.
Okay. I would have to think about it more. But anyway, go ahead.
I'm wondering what the origins of the word itself are. We can look it up.
Yeah, you could ask Professor Google. I don't actually know. Oh, I could tell you this. Okay, this is a good professorial thing to say. In Greek, in ancient Greek, which is where the notion of leisure, as I've been talking about, originated, the word for Greek is skole. That's where we get school and scholastic and all these things from. The word for work is askole, so it's the lack of leisure. So they define work in terms of it not being leisure, rather than the other way around. So that's my little factoid for you.
Related to leisure grew out of that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yes.
Second question.
Oh, he has a second
question.
Third question.
The link between leisure and beauty, truth, and goodness.
it's direct. I think I, for some reason, don't talk about beauty, truth, and goodness directly much. I think sometimes they can sound a little bit like we know what they are already. We just got to look for them. And I don't think any of them are like that. They're all real they're all real complicated when you get into the midst of them, and how we find them depends a lot on who we are, where we are.
What do you think?
Sure. I mean, if leisure is connected with God, which is what I've said, then it's got to be connected to beauty, truth, and goodness. Those are the sort of manifestations of God in the world, right? But I guess, right, I find them less useful than the word leisure. I like to use words that you have to think harder about how to find them.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but you seem to be implying that we should incorporate leisure into our lives rather than live a life of leisure.
I think, well,
that sounds like recreation.
What are you thinking of a life of leisure? Life of leisure has a certain flavor to it that I'm not sure about.
Like more of the monastic tradition than the...
Well, I think the ideal is to live a life of leisure. And I think you can do that in the world. I don't think you need a monastery. That in a way would be a kind of different topic. Because I think for most people, just finding the leisure is a challenge. And the life of leisure is kind of that's like graduate school of leisure, you know. And I think I would be embarrassed to talk about it because I am a failure. I can't, you know, my life is not a life of leisure. I do have leisure sometimes. I think a life of leisure is possible. I think it's a kind of ideal for human beings. And I think it's possible in a variety of walks of life. But I haven't much thought about it. I've thought more about carving it out of an ordinary life.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Hintz.
Thank you.